podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
The accelerating pace of science and technology is raising fundamental questions of ethics in clinical research and in medical practice. Cell therapy, gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9, CAR-T, AI, machine learning are everywhere in the mainstream media and social media, not to mention the scientific and medical literature. At the center of this sometimes stunning innovation is the patient, all of us. It's tempting to look at just the benefits of all this innovation, but what about the risks? Are things moving too fast for our own good? Are we safe? Are our human rights at risk? Who is looking out for us? Dr. Robert Klitzman is professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and at the university's Mailman School of Public Health. He is also director of the university's online and in-person bioethics master's and certificate programs. Dr. Klitzman has written more than 100 scientific journal articles and 9 books, including The Ethics Police, The Struggle to Make Human Research Safe. And he is currently working on a new book titled Designing Babies, How Technology is Changing the Way We Have Children. This book will be published in October 2019. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. At our DIA 2019 Global Annual Meeting, Dr. Klitzman helped lead the session titled Designing Babies, Medical, Ethical, and Social Questions. We're going to talk about these questions now. Dr. Klitzman, thank you for joining me today and welcome.
Thank you very much.
What is the concept of designing babies, and what are some of the medical, ethical, and social questions raised by this concept?
Designing babies refers to the fact that we can now use genetic engineering and genetic testing, as you described, and other technologies to alter the genes of children we may have, and therefore of future generations. So we can now use in vitro fertilization, or IVF. So when egg meets sperm, it creates a one-cell embryo that becomes 2 cells, and 4, then 8, then 16, etc., and eventually one of us. But when there are quite a few cells there, we can take off 1 or 2 cells, and we could do whole genome testing or genetic testing of some kind on it, and we can therefore say, if a couple, let's say, creates 8 or 10 embryos, we can say these are the ones that are going to be boys, these are the ones that are going to be girls, these are the ones that have genes associated with breast and ovarian cancer or with cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease. And people are now choosing, gee, I only want a boy, or I only want a child who does or doesn't have these genes. There are cases where there are deaf couples who say, we want to have a deaf child, a child who cannot hear. Doctor, please make sure you choose the embryos that have genes for deafness. Similarly, there are parents who are both dwarfs and say, I want a child who's a dwarf. Please choose the embryos to use that will do that. We also have parents who now have a child with cancer or anemia who needs continual transfusions of blood or bone marrow or organs, and we can now choose embryos based on HLA typing so that they could be a continual creator of bone marrow for the existing child. Now, obviously, all these begin to raise a number of ethical issues, which involve, one, we want to see that there are benefits, and benefits to whom? Obviously, benefits to the child would be best. If the child is going to die of a terrible disease that can be prevented, and die early, and, you know, in the first year of life, then these technologies are good for making sure the parents are able to have a child who won't die immediately of a terrible disease that's caused by a gene. So there should be some benefit when we're using these technologies, but there are obviously some risks. So Dr. Heijiang Kui in China in November of 2018 used CRISPR to alter the genes of an embryo, which is going one step further, not just looking at the genes and choosing an embryo based on the genes, but in fact altering the genes. He used CRISPR-Cas9 technology to turn off the CCR5 gene, which helps HIV viruses get into the cell. The reason for this was there were fathers who have HIV and want to make sure that they have kids who do not have HIV. And so Dr. Hejiang Kuei said, well, I will alter the gene of the child so that the HIV won't get in. Well, this created a furor because, and again, this is an example of altering the genes of a future child, in this case, because the technology wasn't perfected enough. What he said he was going to take out using CRISPR-Cas9 wasn't the DNA that, in fact, was taken out. There's off-target effects. We still don't have the technology perfected to say we're only going to take out this little bit of DNA. Sometimes we may take out too much. Also, genes have multiple effects. So the CCR5 gene, if you make sure that it doesn't work, that may prevent HIV from getting in, but it lets other viruses get in. There's an increased risk of influenza virus getting in, for instance. So again, there are questions ethically of not just what the potential benefits are, but what the potential risks and how we weigh those. You want to make sure that the benefits outweigh the risks. And then there are ethical questions about who gets to use this technology. So right now, wealthy people are using this technology, wealthy people who have breast cancer, for instance, in their family and have had the breast mutations associated with breast and ovarian cancer, are able to afford to get rid of these mutations from their family and from their descendants, from their children and their children's children. So in the future, it will probably be the case that breast cancer, which now affects both wealthy people and poor people, will increasingly be a disease of poor people because wealthy people were able to get rid of the mutation from their families. So this too is an ethical question in that ethically there are certain principles we believe in. One is we want to make sure that there is benefit to what we're doing. We want to avoid risk. We want to try to have an equal playing field as much as we can. We don't want there to be an increasing disparity between the haves and the have-nots. There are also questions of rights, which you mentioned, the rights of children. Is it fair to create a child who is born deaf or dwarf or has to supply or was created to supply bone marrow repeatedly for a sibling? We believe that children should have an open future, that they should make choices for themselves about what kind of life they lead. And so we're concerned about these issues ethically as well.
These are huge questions, and you've just displayed a vast panorama of what the issues are. At the individual level, individual patients, individual families, would you say it may make some sense to intervene so as to prevent diseases that are genetically linked and could surface if these interventions are not applied? But at the demographic level, at the highest level, how does this tie into natural selection and the distribution of diseases and populations and genotypes and phenotypes that nature has basically driven for millennia? Are we toying with nature at this point? Yes. Is that a good thing, demographically speaking, at the highest levels?
Yes, we are toying with nature. And again, to be clear, there are different technologies, each of which could be used in different ways. So there is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which I described a moment ago, in which we're diagnosing, we're testing embryos before we implant them into the womb. Then there's CRISPR-Cas9, in which we're changing the genes that are in the embryo. And particularly with CRISPR-Cas9, there has been a lot of attention given to it. It's very exciting in that it could lead to lots of potentially great treatments for people. But I would argue it's not ready for prime time. It's not ready for use on a clinical basis. And there is a debate whether or not it's okay on an experimental basis. And I should clarify, the question really is, at what point will it be safe enough to be ready for experiments, for clinical trials? And this, again, is an issue that we need all of us to give attention to because it's an important issue. One issue is that we increasingly know that genes can have multiple effects. So there may be a gene that we may say, well, let's change this gene because it may be good for doing one thing, but that gene may be involved in other organ systems. So even CCR5, we may say, well, okay, it's involved with, as Dr. Hejiang Kuei did, yes, it may decrease the risk of HIV getting into cells, but it may increase the risk of other viruses, increase the risk of other viruses getting to cells. Or there may be a gene that we want to alter because it may lead to, say, Alzheimer's disease, but may also affect cardiac functioning. So we don't yet know enough, I would argue, to start tinkering with genes because they may have multiple effects that we're not aware of. And so when we do start the first human clinical trials and start implanting or transferring embryos that have been gene edited into the womb, and I think that probably will take place in a few years, is my guess. We'll need to follow those people very carefully. There'll still be a lot of risks. But one concern is that there may be doctors who want to do this, who think Dr. Heijun Kui apparently thought he was going to win the Nobel Prize for creating these children in China, for being the first one to do this. So there's a lot of push. People think they're going to make a lot of money on this. People think they're going to become famous. And there may be patients who say, gee, I want to have a child with a few genes added that'll give him extra height, or maybe give him a few extra points of intelligence on an IQ test. So a concern is that people may go ahead because this isn't really regulated anywhere. You know, we don't really have a system of world governance. The WHO had a committee a few months ago that said there should be a moratorium on use of CRISPR, particularly for embryos and transferring those embryos into wombs. But the WHO doesn't have much power. The UN doesn't have much power. The UN says something and countries do what they want anyway. And so you have doctors, scientists all over the world who may do what they want. So I would say, yes, there are dangers. Yes, this is playing God or playing with nature, and there are risks. And it can affect things at a societal level. I think that having scientists be aware of these issues, and I think opportunities like this where people involved in drug innovation and biotech, people who are involved in these worlds, be aware of the potential risks so they can balance these and think through. That doesn't mean never do this kind of research, but that we just need to be careful that we know enough about the risks that we could get informed consent, that patients understand what they're getting into, et cetera.
I'm tempted to speculate that the technical issues will be resolved over time, the ones that you mentioned. The technology, the implications of the technology, the side effects, the unintended consequences, that this over time will be figured out. And so the technology at some point will be ready. But the social and ethical questions remain and will remain for a long time, I would think. I'd like your opinion on that. Once we've solved the technological side of things, how do we then address the social and ethical questions? And who decides who gets the benefit of these technologies, interventions, and innovations? Who makes these decisions in the end? Who gets the innovation? Who doesn't? Why? Should it be a body that decides this, a world body? How do you think about this?
So again, it depends sort of on the what technology. So right now, for instance, we now are using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to prevent various diseases from being passed on. And there are people who have, as I mentioned, the BRCA genes, the genes associated with breast and ovarian cancer, who are able to afford to pay out of pocket to have IVF done to make sure that these genes do not get passed on. That's something that wealthier people are doing. So in fact, right now, today, there are people all over the world who are saying, I don't want these genes passed down, and they're making sure that those genes don't get passed down. So train has already left the station, if you will, as we say, in that decisions are now being made based on who has the money to do some of these things. And again, part of the problem is these technologies are relatively expensive. By that, I mean that one cycle of IVF costs, let's say, $15,000, $20,000 US in the US, cheaper in other countries. You may need to do more than one cycle to do it. People who have $50,000, let's say, to make sure that no one in their family, none of their children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren have mutations that have been serious enough to affect people in their family. So these social issues, again, are important, obviously. People don't realize that this is now going on, or a lot of people don't realize it. We need to make political decisions. We need to educate people, patients, doctors, researchers, people in industry and pharma and biotech, so they're aware of these issues. So if companies do move in this space increasingly, as they are, that they're aware of the potential backlash, the ethical problems. You don't want government come in and say, this is all bad, let's stop all of it. To me, that's not a good answer. You want to try to make sure that the costs can come down so everyone can afford it. Some countries, I should say, have quite generous coverage for IVF. The U.S., unfortunately, I think is one of the countries that does not have much coverage for IVF or for PGD. A lot of insurance companies don't want to cover it, PGD, because they say that even though getting rid of a terrible disease now, let's say a disease that may kill a child in the first few years of life, yes, PGD is cost effective. That mutation does not get passed down. You're avoiding very expensive medical bills for a child. But insurance companies in the U.S. at least will say, well, we know that on average, patients stay with us only 2-3 years before they switch jobs or on another insurance plan. So our company, Company X, which is the insurer right now, why should we pay for PGD, which may cost $50,000, because our company is not the one who would have to take care of the child if the child were to be born and have those costs. So this speaks to the larger healthcare system, the way each of our countries has its healthcare system built, what is covered, what is not. Those decisions are the ones that are going to determine who gets these technologies, who can design babies, who can't, etc.
Should there be a political, legislated, regulated process? For instance, in your hypothetical of a family where both parents are hearing impaired and they would like to have a child who is also hearing impaired, should somebody step in and say, no, you can't do that because a hearing impaired child would be a burden on society and the learning, the educational system, et cetera, or not? Should parents feel free and be free to make those kinds of decisions and requests?
So I think that this is where ethics comes in as opposed to law. To pass a law, laws can be very cumbersome. They take years to do. The technology is going to advance as quickly. I personally think that professional organizations, the doctors involved in reproductive medicine, obstetrics and gynecologists, should pass very clear guidelines that they follow, saying this is very problematic. We should avoid this. This is okay under these circumstances. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine does that to a certain degree, could be doing more. It's put out very good guidelines on some areas, but these new technologies are quickly coming at us. And there is a need for more professional organizations to come up with strong language that will be professional guidelines that can help us. I think professional associations have an important role. Also, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, collects data from clinics, but could collect a lot more data that would help us understand this. So we do not know now how much PGD goes on in the United States, and we don't know specifically what it's used for. So we do not know in the United States how often people are saying, I just want to have a boy, just give me a boy embryo. And again, this begins to get into the area of eugenics, which is saying, I'm going to pick the genes of a child, not for medical reasons, but for social reasons. Even the CDC saying we're collecting this information, we're now going to ask, how often are clinics doing this? We don't know. We could easily find out. The CDC should collect that kind of data. It may be too early to get government involved, and governments today are some are conservative and maybe think a lot of this should not be allowed, even when others of us think that some of it is for good purposes. It requires nuanced understandings of the issues. As I said, you don't want to shut the whole technology down. In some cases, it may be right. Now, the case of a deaf parent wanting deaf kids, this is part of a larger, much larger debate. My own personal feeling is that children have a right to an open future, but this gets into deep philosophical.
The rights of the individual to use an available technology versus the needs or pressures of society for that individual or individuals to not use it for whatever reason. Yes. How would that be even approach a resolution?
In the case of the deaf parents wanting the deaf child, for instance, there it's the rights of the parents versus the rights of the child. The parents may say, look, we like being deaf. You know, we want a deaf child. I think that in a lot of these issues, the rights of the child are not sufficiently taken into account. So it's easy for the doctors to say, sure, and for the parents to say that's what they want, and the doctors say, fine. I think we need to think about, was that fair to the child? In terms of the desire of parents, the parents may say, gee, I want a child who has perfect pitch, or I want these genes altered. And again, an issue is we don't know what the risks are. So it's sort of the parental desire to say, or the parental wish, gee, I want a child, please put in those extra genes that'll give some extra IQ points. You may put the extra genes in and it turns out it leads to cardiac problems or it leads to liver problems. We don't know yet. And so I would argue there, we should not just consider, well, this is what the parent wants, and so we'll do it for the parent as the patient, but rather we need to think what the risks are to the child. We need to weigh these continually, and I agree with you. I think that the justice issue of, is this the kind of world we want where wealthy people can afford to have better genes? And unfortunately, we know that the Nazi experience showed us that when a society decides we're going to improve the genes of a society as a whole, that could have terrible consequences, where they'll say some people are second-class citizens and we'll kill them. And in fact, of course, there have been science fiction movies and novels that have addressed some of this. There was a movie called Gattaca a few years ago, I think with Ethan Hawke, in which the moment a baby is born, the doctors do a genetic analysis and say, is this child genetically inferior or superior? And if they're inferior, certain jobs they won't be able to get and we're not going to give them an education much. If they're superior, then we're going to give them a lot of resources.
So we need profound questions, absolutely profound questions that you illuminated the issues very, very well. One of your other published books, The Struggle to Make Human Research Safe. What are the biggest pain points in this area, in your opinion?
In the book, The Ethics Police, the issue is that we need to regulate and oversee to some degree what scientists and industry and academia do, but we don't want to overregulate. We don't want to underregulate or overregulate. And the question is, what's the right amount? So we all have conflicts of interest. Many scientists, I think, are a wonderful group of people. I'm one of them. My best friends are scientists. But there are some scientists who will engage in things they shouldn't do, whether intentionally or unintentionally. They may, if left to their own devices, they may say, you know, here's my treatment for cancer. I made it in my bathroom sink last night, and I'm going to give it to every patient I see today. So we need some set of guidelines. We need institutional review boards, research ethics committees.
Well, we have those. Those are already in place and have been for decades.
Yes, that's right. They run into problems and there are controversies. So on the one hand, many people call research ethics committees or IRBs the ethics police. They feel that IRBs go too far and say, no, you can't do this research. You can't do that research. What do you mean you're going to do this? You can't do that. We won't approve it. And some researchers feel, well, if they say that, I better not do it. So there are times IRBs have been criticized. I should say that I do not think IRBs are the ethics police, but I think that the fact that they're seen that way is important and suggests that we need to try to work together with IRBs, researchers do. A lot of times IRBs may not have, unfortunately, enough expertise in a particular area and may say, gee, that sounds dangerous to me. And so there needs to be more of a dialogue often with researchers saying, well, no, here's the data showing that it's not that dangerous or the benefits outweigh the risks, et cetera. There are also a lot of debates about informed consent forms, for instance. So we have studies where consent forms are 50 pages long, filled with very dense information that participants don't understand. That's not good. I think people, particularly if we're giving them experimental drugs, should understand what they're getting into. And a 50-page form that people are just going to, their eyes glaze over, is not a good solution. There needs to be a way to educate patients better so they understand what they're getting into and what to expect. That would lead to less patients dropping out of clinical trials if they understand what they're getting into when they start.
In your observation, given that this is about the safety of human research, do you think there is a great deal of human research being done these days that is not safe and should not be conducted?
I would not say that, no. Certainly there are, every year there is some scandal somewhere where patients die in an experiment and should not have died. There is research that IRBs turn down that may be good research. There are some studies, though, that are for Me Too drugs that may not be having the most social benefit. That may be okay. There are ethical questions that come up, for instance, with post-trial access. So there may be a study of a drug in India or China or Malaysia, and if the drug shows that it works, there are questions. What is the responsibility of the drug company to continue to give the drug for a period of time after that? Should it be for 3 years, for 1 year? How available should it be? Should it be just for the people in the trial? So there are ethical questions of wanting to make sure there's a fair deal. A lot of problem is that as we develop new technologies, and partly with AI, and as you mentioned, gene editing and gene therapy and CAR T, we need to make sure that we continue to have a robust system of IRBs that doesn't just rubber stamp everything on the one hand, but doesn't block research either. And unfortunately, there have been problems on both sides where some IRBs at times block research and other IRBs don't think things through enough and approve research studies, and sometimes patients die. So particularly in the developing world where most industry research is done, we just need to continue to be as careful as we can. And as I said, there are challenges. I think we can address them, but they need more attention than they're getting now in terms of informed consent. We know that people often don't understand much about when they can withdraw, if they can withdraw, et cetera.
How do medical ethics and research ethics apply when AI or machine learning are introduced into clinical research? It's a huge topic, I understand, and we only have a few minutes, but what are your thoughts about this?
So there's a few issues that come up with the ethics of AI and machine learning. And I should say that on our website at Columbia Bioethics, we have a number of free videos and information on this and other topics, as well as courses if people are interested. And we have a lot of people from pharma and biotech doing our courses, et cetera. One issue is bias. So you want to make sure that the data going into algorithms and therefore algorithms are not biased. And there have been problems. So for instance, There have been studies using AI, for instance, to help judges decide, will a criminal commit the crime again? And it turns out that the data has been looking at mostly in the United States, people who are African-American, people of Latino descent, who, if you look in the database so far, because a lot of the criminal justice system will target certain people unfairly, they may be, certain groups may be overrepresented among, quote, criminals in the data system. And so the algorithm will say, well, these people are more likely to commit crimes. In fact, they may not be, but it's just because of the bias built into the system. So you want to make sure you avoid things like that. For instance, if you have data mostly on Caucasians, the algorithm results may not be accurate for people who aren't Caucasian. So bias is one. Another issue is, what happens if something goes wrong? What if the algorithm is wrong? Who's responsible? If we tell doctors, use this algorithm to dose a patient or to decide what medication to give a patient, what if the algorithm comes up with some answer and the patient dies? Is the doctor responsible, or is the programmer responsible? Is no one responsible? These issues have not been figured out fully, and I think they need attention.
Almost reminds me of driverless cars. If a driverless car is involved in an accident, whose fault is it? Right?
Exactly right.
Would that be a reasonable analogy?
That's a very reasonable analogy, absolutely. And so you just want to think that through. So it's somehow that people need to think what's fair. And I don't have an answer to that offhand, but I think that it needs attention. Someone should be responsible. The notion that, oh, it's just the computer is responsible, that's not quite acceptable, maybe. But again, who should be in? It gets into how doctors, for instance, will use AI. Should they be told, use AI instead of making your own decision? Probably not. Probably doctors should be told this is one tool. On the other hand, because we don't know the algorithms or what's in the black box of the algorithm, doctors may be told this medication is best for the patient and not know how the machine came up with that. So again, these issues need to be thought through. And another is, who, with big data involved, is who owns the data? So this is an ongoing issue. I think that a lot of patients are happy to have data shared. We just want to make sure it's de-identified. The problem is, when we have genomic data, often it can be identifying. And so again, we just need to make sure that we know what we're doing and have a sense of what patients want or don't want, what's fair, what's not. These are other ethical issues as we go forward that we need to think about and be clear about.
In your mind, looking down the road, what is the ideal collaboration between the doctor and artificial intelligence?
Data and research is very important. So ideally, physicians, and I'm a physician, rather than just be told this is what the AI algorithm said, do it, we should know this is what the AI algorithm said. And this algorithm, we then studied it in 1,000 cases. We did a double-blind study. 1,000 cases of the doctor making his or her own decision, 1,000 cases or whatever of using AI, and the patients who had AI used did better, worse, the same, or better for heart disease and not as good for neurologic disease, or better for MIs but not as good for something else. So I just think we need to know more. And a concern I have is that the research may not get done. In other words, there's a lot of commercial interests which are developing the technology, which is great. But there's often a push to quickly roll things out into clinical practice without knowing fully what the risks and benefits are. There are potential benefits, but I think the more we know about what the risks are, the more educated decisions we can make.
Dr. Klitzman, we need to close, and we could go on for a long time. These are huge questions, and I want to thank you for illuminating the issues and the questions that arise around these technologies, their applications, and the ethical and social implications. Quite a fascinating area. I really appreciate your insights today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For DIA Global Forum, I'm Alberto Grignolo. To
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.